Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. On this archive edition of Midday, the timely lessons of James Baldwin. In the 1950s, by the age of 30, Baldwin had become one of America's most eminent African-American writers and a provocative and compelling critic of racial inequality. Dr. Eddie Glaude of Princeton University has written an eloquent and trenchant analysis of the work of James Baldwin in a book that explores how Baldwin's critique of America in his time resonates so acutely with this pivotal moment in our time. It's called Begin Again: James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Because we are rebroadcasting our conversation, we aren't taking calls and comments today. Dr. Eddie Glaude joins me after the news. Good afternoon and welcome to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. When the novelist, journalist, playwright, and activist James Baldwin died in 1987, his place in the panoply of great American writers was assured. He is remembered as one of the most eloquent observers of the Black experience and an insightful and compelling critic of racial inequality. He was prolific and provocative and one of the most important and invigorating public intellectuals of his time. Dr. Eddie Glaude is one of the most important and invigorating public intellectuals of our time. He's the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University and a former president of the American Academy of Religion. He'll be giving the annual Martin Luther King Day lecture for the Enoch Pratt Library and the Reginald F. Lewis Museum tomorrow afternoon. Eddie Glaude's latest book draws on his imaginative reading of James Baldwin and his own trenchant observations about the current American moment. It's called Begin Again: James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. We spoke last August. Eddie Glaude joined me on Zoom. Eddie, welcome back. It's been a minute. It's good to talk to you again.
It has been a while. It's delightful to be back with you.
We last talked about another wonderful book, Democracy in Black, back mm-hmm. at the 2016 election. But I have to tell you, this book on Baldwin is just tremendous. I just so enjoyed it. It was revelatory in a million different ways. You write in the very beginning, in the prologue, that it's a strange book because it isn't quite biography. It isn't quite literary criticism. It isn't quite straightforward history, although it's certainly all of those things. But there's a lot of incredible, original, and very personal thinking in this book, isn't this? This is a very personal book for you.
Yeah, you know, well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. I've been walking with Baldwin in my head for about 30 years. And, you know, finally I had to bring him from backstage and to think with him. And you know, Baldwin is an exacting companion. He demands much of you. And as he's demanding all of these things, particularly a kind of honesty, where you have to confront your own, you know, as I've put it, the scaffolding of my own lies, you know, you're also trying to maintain your own voice as you write with him because he's a giant, you know. And so the book was difficult to write on so many different levels. I barely survived because, you know, I found myself engaging in this kind of introspection because, you know, Jimmy has this, he has this commitment to the Socratic dictum that the unexamined life is not worth living. And he follows from that in order to say anything substantive about the world, you have to first say something honest about yourself. You have to interrogate the messiness of who you are because the messiness of the world is a reflection of our interior lives. And so the book is this odd kind of move between biography, you know, literary engagement, social criticism. And so I just beg of the reader to be patient and walk with me as I try to put my passions on the page.
Well, the patience is very, very much rewarded. You talk about how you've been thinking about him and engaging him for 30 years. You've been teaching Baldwin at Princeton and perhaps other places. When he died in 1987, you would have been in your 20s. Did you know him personally?
No, I never met him at all. You know, I was at Morehouse when he passed in 87. I had first encountered him while I was at Morehouse College in Atlanta, probably in my, I would say my sophomore year, but hadn't really read him seriously. No, I've never met him in person, but my God, he seems like he's a walking partner, a close friend.
You write about what you call the after times, and how Baldwin wrote in after times, not unlike the times we are currently living in. What are the after times? I guess this dates from the civil rights movement through maybe the Reagan administration. So, I mean, explain what you mean by after times and how there are parallels to Baldwin's time and our time.
Sure. So I get the phrase from Walt Whitman's Democratic Vistas. And Whitman is writing in that period right after the Civil War and right before the Gilded Age. And he sees the country, right, trying desperately to figure out what it's going to do. And it's doubling down on its ugliness. And in some ways, Whitman is contributing to it, right? So the Whitman who was decidedly abolitionist was against the extension of citizenship to Black folk. He thought we had the capacity of baboons, as he put it in one of his Brooklyn editorials. But, you know, he's writing in Democratic Vistas is one of my favorite books, ironically. And he's writing about materialism choking the life out of democracy, out of the potential of the nation, that we've been hollowed out in some ways. And so the after times is this kind of metaphor for the crossroads, this moment when a world is dying and a world is desperately coming into being, but there's a kind of darkness that shadows everything, right? So there's this sense in which Baldwin was writing in this moment. Of course, he achieves his fame, right, at the height of the civil rights movement with the publication of The Fire Next Time in 1963. He's at the height of his fame. But he also lives long enough to see the country set the stage for the assassination of Dr. King. He witnessed the death of Malcolm and Medgar and the death of unknown folk who line the Mississippi River in some ways. And Baldwin had to figure out how to pick up the pieces because he saw post-68, you know, not only the election of Richard Nixon in 68, but he saw, you know, the clamoring of the Hard Hat Rebellion. He saw what this forgotten American, this silent majority, what they were clamoring for. And in some ways, he glimpsed Ronald Reagan on the horizon in 1980. And then, of course, laid down kind of some insights that would in some ways anticipate Donald Trump. But what's so fascinating about it, right? So he sees Reagan elected. He lives long enough to see Reagan elected in 1980. And for many Americans, we really don't understand how profoundly problematic that election was. Reagan was as notorious for Black activists as George Wallace. And for him to be the redeemer in chief was a backhand to the face.
And he has achieved a saintly position within the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And you write about the sort of central premise of Baldwin's understanding of the American condition, about how it coheres around a set of practices, you write, taken together, constitute something that you're going to refer to as the lie.
Yeah.
So explain what the lie is, and is the lie, for example, part of or completely the reason that a Ronald Reagan is, you know, so revered in certain political circles?
Well, you know, I think the through line in American history, and we talked about this so long ago, it seems, is the value gap, right? This belief that white people matter more than others. And that belief informs and shapes our dispositions. It colors our practices. It's evident in our social and political and economic arrangements, in the very structures, the skeleton, the backbone of the country, as it were. And that belief, I think, is consistent across American history. So, but it looks differently under different material conditions. So what the value gap would look like in the context of slavery will be very different than in the context of Jim Crow, or very different in the context of having our first Black president, but it still obtains. The lie is that which provides cover for that belief and those practices and those arrangements. In 1964, Baldwin wrote a piece entitled The White Problem. And I thought it's a nut graph. It kind of captured exactly what he was trying to get at. I'll read it for you really quickly.
Please.
The people who settled the country had a fatal flaw. They could recognize a man when they saw one. They knew he wasn't anything else but a man. But since they were Christian, and since they had already decided that they came here to establish a free country, the only way to justify the role this chattel was playing in one's life was to say that he was not a man. For if he wasn't, then no crime had been committed. That lie, Baldwin writes, is the basis of our present trouble. So the lie is not only the story we tell about the capacities of Black folk, right? Our passions, right? The fact that we are less than human, that we are, that our condition as slaves is justified by the fact that we lack the requisite skills to take on the burden of citizenship. It's the lie that we tell about our treatment of Black folk and people around the world. It's the lie that we tell ourselves that we are the Redeemer Nation, the shining city on the hill, in order to protect our innocence, the illusion, the willful ignorance that many of us embrace so that we can turn a blind eye to the evils that we've done. And the lie is the lie we tell ourselves when reality impinges upon us, when reality asserts itself to disclose the illusions for what they are. And so we reassert the lie when history and the present tries to reveal to us what we've actually done and who we actually are. And so it's Baldwin insists that we tell ourselves the truth as a way of releasing ourselves into a brighter future. So Reagan, as you rightly said, was his election, at least Baldwin understood it to be, was this attempt to reach for this Hollywood fantasy, this B-list actor who could affirm that this country was indeed a white nation in the vein of old Europe.
Eddie Glaude's latest book is called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. And Eddie, you write that this lie, it's interesting, Baldwin almost has a certain sympathy for the oppressors in the lie. Southern white, in particular, whites in the South had to continuously lie to justify what was going on in the world and what they were doing. They had to lie about the inferiority of Black people. They had to lie about what they were doing under the cover of night. You write that they had to lie that they were Christian. And for Baldwin, you write that the accumulation of all of these lies suffocated the white Southerner.
Yeah.
Suffocates everybody. And so it wasn't just about the oppressiveness and the malignancy of what this meant for Black people, but for the nation as a whole.
Right, because, you know, the idea, you know, we bear the burden, of course. We have to raise our children in the midst of this stuff, but something happens to the character of those who actually engage in the debasement, right? As you debase me, you debase yourself, right? There's a sense in which Baldwin and you know, the most stark example that I can reach for, right, is the slave owner who knew that he was selling his child, right, on the slave auction block. He knew it. Right. And what monstrous development had to be present for that to happen? What has distorted the soul in such a way that you could sell your own baby? Right. Because you really didn't recognize that child as a human being or the like. So Baldwin is saying the depth of the lie, the depth of the dishonesty, right, it not only impacts the lives of Black folk, but more. In a much more devastating way, right? It turns the debaser into monsters, particularly when they refuse to confront what they've done.
Dr. Eddie Glaude, the book is called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. We'll have more with Eddie Glaude on the other side of this quick break. Because this program was pre-recorded, we can't take your calls and emails today. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're revisiting a conversation I had in August with Dr. Eddie Glaude, the chair of the African American Studies Department at Princeton University. His most recent book is a very thoughtful peroration on the work of James Baldwin and its resonance with the current moment in America. It's called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. A reminder that because our conversation was pre-recorded, we aren't taking any new calls, emails, or tweets. So, Eddie Glaude, is the fact that the central tenet of this lie is that black people don't matter as much as white people, what makes this particular American moment so resonant with what Baldwin was writing about 50 years ago, 40 years ago? Literally the movement is called Black Lives Matter. And there seems to be some indication that there is now multiracial, multigenerational acknowledgement of that truth. Is that one of the things, or is that the central thing that makes you believe that this particular moment particularly resonates with Baldwin's work?
Well, you know, in some ways, yes. I think it's against the backdrop of Trumpism that really draws the connection. You know, when the country elected Ronald Reagan, it in effect closed the door on the prospect of being otherwise that the civil rights movement of the Black freedom struggle of the mid-20th century offered it. Right? So it was a choice. The country doubled down on its ugliness, and Ronald Reagan was charged to dismantle it all. So what, the last major piece of legislation of the Great Society was the Fair Housing Act of 68. 12 years later, Reagan is elected. And so there's this sense in which the reach for the fantasy, right, to kind of confirm that, you know, the value gap still obtains, right, was a part of Baldwin's aftertimes. And here we are coming out of 8 years of the first Black president. And then the country, or Donald Trump, wins the Electoral College. And Trumpism is unleashed, right? Which is just simply a caricatured version of what we experienced with Reagan. And, you know, people want to tell the story of Trump as if it only goes through Pat Buchanan, George Wallace, and Strom Thurmond, when in fact, when you look at the particulars of whatever ideology he governs by, it's really a caricatured version of Reaganism. And so it's really, what does it mean for the country to have reached for another fantasy, right? Not a B-list actor, but a reality show guy, right? And so then in the midst of this, you know, we have to witness, you know, 8 minutes and 46 seconds over and over again on loop of a public lynching of George Floyd. And so the country's in this moment, right, where it was doubling down on its ugliness. And then we find ourselves at this kind of inflection point, this moral reckoning, where the country has a chance to be otherwise. And already we're hearing reassertions of the lie. And so I reached for Jimmy in so many ways to save myself, because, you know, I was so angry and rageful and despairing, to try to find language to describe what the hell we're going through and how we might pick up the pieces to push this boulder up the hill again.
Eddie Glaude's latest book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lesson for Our Own. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. And you talk, Eddie Glaude, about the danger of exceptionalizing Trump. You know, I know when he was elected after Charlottesville and his hideous comments then, or even just a couple of days ago with Jonathan Swan not acknowledging the significance of John Lewis. People say, well, you know, he shouldn't have said that because that's not who we are as Americans. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, it is. I mean, we got to admit, you know, that may be exactly who we are. What is the danger in saying that Trump is this anomaly as opposed to, you know, a true representation of a lot of what's going on in our society?
It's a way of displacing our sins onto another, right? So you can you know, virtue signal by just simply decrying Trumpism. Trump is the evil, you know, villain. And then we're just looking for the hero. It's the stuff of melodrama, really. And it's the same way in which it's the way in which the country has demonized the South, right? As if the South, if only that region didn't do what it did, if only that region would step out of the darkness, step out of the cave and embrace enlightenment and genuine liberalism, the country would be better, right? Not really admitting that Anglo-Saxonism as an ideology which undergirded America's imperial ambition in the late 19th century, right, wasn't a Southern thing, right? When we look at the statues, the Confederate statues built as a result of the Lost Cause, they weren't just in the South, or, you know, Malcolm X would say, as long as you're south of the Canadian border, you're in the South. But the point here, is that, you know, we have to find the villain, right? We have to displace our sins onto another. And in doing so, we absolve ourselves of responsibility. So we have to exceptionalize Trump. You know, he's everything. And then we tell ourselves, if only we just got rid of him, American democracy will be okay. We will be saved. And, that's an illusion that we trade in, because in some ways, America, in some ways, we are often like, you know, Never Never Land, right? Populated by lost boys and lost girls who refuse to take responsibility and accountability for anything.
And I was very taken with your reference to Nietzsche, who talked about the ability, the importance of the ability to forget. And so I'm interested in how this lines up with our clear need, and you make this argument so compellingly and convincingly, that this lie has to be acknowledged, it has to be dealt with, it has to be thought about and thoroughly vetted. But Nietzsche says we must cultivate our ability to forget. It is possible to live with almost no memory, Nietzsche said, but without forgetting, it's quite impossible to live at all. So it's not a matter of forgetting the lie, is it? I mean, how do those two things line up?
So in that moment when I'm invoking Nietzsche, in that moment, I'm really trying to think through the enduring impact of trauma. Right, of pain and wound. One of the things about, you know, walking with Baldwin, particularly in his later years, is to understand how wounded and how traumatized not only he is, but Black America is. Right. So what does it mean, for example, that we have to continue to raise our children under these conditions? We've already invoked the horror of a parent, of a mother having to watch her child being sold, even if that child was fathered by a slave master. What does it mean that we have to raise our children in the face of, you know, 8 minutes and 46 seconds where this man has his knee on the neck of another human being and he doesn't recognize his humanity, and everyone is watching this on a perpetual loop, engaging in the pornography of Black suffering and death, and we have to then turn to our children and try to raise them? What does it mean to have to do this generation after generation after generation, right? Baldwin is trying to capture trauma. And sometimes you just got to be able to forget something. You know, Toni Morrison says in Beloved, some stories are not meant to pass on, to be passed on. It's the only way we can get up in the morning.
Mm.
Right? Right? Yeah. Now, so that trauma, how do we evidence it in the level of form, right? Because Baldwin's like, you know, even when King was murdered in 68, even when they blew the bottom half of his face off, we still had to get up because white people didn't stop being white people. They killed Bobby Hutton not too long afterwards, right? Everything kept happening, even when Charlottesville happened and the young woman was killed in Charlottesville and we saw the ugliness of white supremacy. We couldn't grieve because Donald Trump came down the escalator the very next day. White people kept being white people. So when I invoke Nietzsche in that moment, I'm thinking about, how do we get up? How do we muster the energy to open our eyes and take it all on again? There's a story, I'll tell it really quickly. Dr. King was engaged I think it was 1967, Taylor Branch talks about this or writes about it, engaged in an action in a small southern town in Mississippi, 67. And he watched white men with axe handles and tree limbs attack young children as they were let out of an elementary school. He watched them. And he retreated to his bed and refused to get up. Andrew Young said, we had seen activists, you know, movement folk get depressed, and but we had never seen, like, we couldn't wake him. He refused to get up. And it just so happened that Joan Baez was coming to help organize in this particular action. And she sat down next to him and sang Pilgrim Sorrow a cappella. And he opened his eyes and he got up. How do we get up in the morning? Mm. How do we keep pushing this boulder up the hill? Now, that is apart from what do we do with the lie, right? We tell us that you see the move I'm making?
Yeah. And the title of the book, Begin Again, comes from Baldwin's last novel. And in that, he talks about, he says, responsibility cannot be lost, it can only be abdicated. So if one refuses abdication, one begins again, just as Dr. King got up and began again. The significance of beginning again, and at one point you talk about doing your good works over. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
You know, that's Revelation's second chapter, verse 5, doing one's first works over. What does it mean to return to where you started and to assess what did you intend to do? Right. When I think about this in the context of my own life. Right. So, I told you Baldwin made me confront the scaffolding of my own lies. And what does it mean to try to step into a different way of being in the world, to be more mature, to leave behind the swaddling clothes, as it were? And one of the things that I kept kept confronting was how vulnerable I am, I'm a vulnerable little boy, and why, right? Because I'm still dealing with, as I've been saying, I'm still dealing with the fear that my father deposited in my gut, right? Trying to work my way through it, trying to prove that I'm not a scared little boy over and over and over again. What does it mean to understand that? And then to try to act in the world. So what does it mean, America, that you say that you were committed to freedom, that you were committed to liberty and democracy and freedom, and what got in the way? Tell the story. Do one's first works over. How do we imagine this place in a way that affirms the dignity and standing of every human being? How do we deal with the fact that the land that we stand upon is drenched in blood? How do we deal with that and not get stuck, but to use that knowledge, that revelation, as the ground to imagine ourselves differently, to imagine and build a more just world, do one's first works over, right? I think it involves this dramatic encounter with what we've done, what has gotten in the way, and who do we aspire to be? Does that make sense? I'm not sure if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does, and it is so complex and so, you know, nuanced and longstanding. I mean, it is just so much tougher being a black man or a black woman in America than it is being a white man or a white woman in America. And as you say, you know, how are you raising your kids? What are the stories that you're telling your kids and how they resonate with the things that your father told you? But does it seem to you, because it seems to a whole lot of other people who perhaps are somewhat Pollyannish about it, that this is a moment where that kind of progress can be made, that like the 60s, like the Voting Rights Act in 65 and the Civil Rights Act in 64 and even the Fair Housing Act in 68, those moments were moments of huge progress, you know, leaps ahead after a lot of suffering and years of work. Yeah. Does this moment with the streets full of people protesting those monuments that people have to walk by all the time, protesting the way police departments handle crowds and handle citizens on a daily basis, protesting the way money is allocated for law enforcement and away from other things. Is this a moment where you have any optimism and hope about the possibility of another big leap?
I'm never optimistic. you know, I'm doubtful. Yeah. I'm doubtful of Voltaire's Candide. You know, this is not Panglossian optimism, right? But I'm hopeful, but it's a blues soaked hope. You know, we've been here before, you know, and America is so quick to congratulate itself about tinkering around the edges and then expect gratitude. You know, mm-hmm. We're so quick to kind of say, look, see what we've done. Because in some ways, many of our fellows view racial justice as a philanthropic enterprise, as a charitable gesture. And once you give, you want to go back to your life as it was or as it is.
And this very thing happened to Baldwin. He was the darling of the New York liberals. And then all of a sudden, he started saying things that they didn't want to hear. And he said, wait a minute.
There's a reason why he never got the Nobel, I think, you know, because there's a reason why he was never really acknowledged in his time, at least in the United States, at the level of awards and recognition of that sort. But, you know, I think we're at a moment of reckoning. It's like the blues man's crossroads. You know, choices have to be made. There's no middle ground. And there's no guarantee, Tom, where we're going to end up on the other side of this. But, you know, I do have faith in us. Wherever human beings are, we have a chance. But we have to recognize that we're simultaneously miracles and disasters. Mm. And once we understand that, we can't be Pollyannish. Once we acknowledge our history, we dare not be Pollyannish. We just need to come to the moment of reckoning with the level of seriousness that moment requires.
And of course, when it came to people being disowned by the, you know, white liberal elite, Dr. King had the same problem when he switched his focus to, you know, the war in Vietnam. But I talk a little bit before we take a quick break about the relationship between James Baldwin and Dr. King. At one point, you write that in 1963, the FBI caught King on tape expressing some concern about Baldwin, saying that he was generally uninformed regarding the movement. However, when Dr. King died, you also write that Baldwin went into a huge funk, a great depression. I mean, what it was a complicated relationship. How do you see it?
You know, I think it's a combination of things, right? So King wanted to leverage Baldwin's celebrity to help raise money for the movement. Baldwin was identified with the movement in so many ways, particularly with CORE and STNC, that is the Congress of Racial Equality, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. David Lemming actually says that he joined those two organizations. But you know what I think at the heart of it, though, Thomas, is, of course, Baldwin's, you know, Jimmy's sexuality. And he didn't hide it. And I think it was class. Now, Jimmy grew up in the hood.
He came from two different universes.
Oh, my God. Dramatically different universe. Jimmy's not from Sugar Hill. Right. He's educated in the hood of Harlem and in Greenwich Village and in the alleyways of Paris. So and Dr. King is Morehouse trained. He comes from, you know, black preacher royalty. There's a different sentiment, temperament. One is reserved. The other is prone to dramatic outbursts. You can make the decisions of who am I describing in those moments.
Yeah.
But you know, I think there's just a temperamental difference. And Baldwin writes about this in No Name in the Street. Even though they both were, you know, committed and were willing to risk their lives for us, they understood the differences they understood the differences between how they occupied space and time.
We're listening to an archive edition of Midday. Dr. Eddie Glaude is the chair of the African American Studies Department at Princeton University and a contributor for MSNBC. We're listening to a conversation Dr. Glaude and I had in August about his latest book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. We'll have more with Eddie Glaude after this quick break. Our program was recorded earlier, so we aren't taking any new calls or online comments. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, we're listening to an archive edition of Midday. My guest is Dr. Eddie Glaude, the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. He's also a contributor to MSNBC, and in addition to many scholarly books and articles, his essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Huffington Post, and Time magazine. We're talking about his latest book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. One of the lessons Dr. Glaude offers is the observation that the effects of racism, while felt viscerally, regularly, and malignantly by African Americans, are also enervating and debilitating to our country as a whole. Glaude writes, quote, "This is the real American dilemma. Acknowledging the moral effects of a way of life emptied of genuine meaning because of a lie that denies the things we have done." So, Eddie, we have a tweet from a listener who brings up something that you do address in this book, and this is something we talked about in 2016. At the time, you were urging black voters to leave the presidential ballot blank. Barack Obama had been elected in 2008. Here we are 8 years later. And so this tweeter asks if you regret that effort. And you do talk about this in the book. What did you think then and what do you think now?
Well, to answer directly, I don't regret it. I just think I was wrong in this sense. And let me explain what I mean. You know, in 2016, you know, when I thought that it was going to be a choice between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, I was trying to figure out how do we talk about the devastation that had happened in Black America specifically, right? What the Great Recession had done, what it had wrought. And for 8 years, we had kind of muted issues around race outside of Black Lives Matter because we were trying to protect the left flank, the right flank of Barack Obama from these vicious racists who were going after him. And so I thought we had a chance to break the back of Clintonism in the Democratic Party, to kind of move from this corporate approach that had led to welfare reform, quote unquote, that led to the crime bill, quote unquote, you know, all of this stuff, you know, shifting the interest in some ways from workers to Silicon Valley and the like. I wanted a more progressive vision that would take seriously the issue of race in the country. And I knew we had some power and I wanted us to leverage it. You had to do more than treat Black voters as cattle chewing cud, I argued. And then when the Republican Party nominated Donald Trump, I really thought I had space because I did not believe that the country would elect someone so obviously unqualified to be the president of the United States. I was so wrong. And as a lifetime reader of Jimmy Baldwin, I should have known better. Because in some ways, Donald Trump tapped into this resentment, this grievance, this fear, this hatred. And Baldwin says that, you know, he said this when he was in 1980, that 1980 election, when he was faced with the choice between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, right? And Carter had turned his back on Black folk, as many people argued, with his, you know, policies of austerity. And Baldwin said, sometimes, you know, we've fought so hard for the vote and didn't realize we don't have anything to vote for. Sometimes when Black people vote, they just simply vote to buy themselves some time. And I should have known that in 2016, that perhaps we needed to buy ourselves some time.
And you also write about how it was a mistake to think of or to frame Barack Obama's election and re-election as an ending. In that it is better seen as a beginning. It was a lot of people wanted to leap on the notion that, okay, Obama's election was the culmination of all of these generations of struggle for racial equality. But in fact, you see it as a launching point.
Yeah, you know, I mean, people tell that story because they're trying to justify their own position, their own desire to walk the corridors of power. One of the fascinating things about the Obama years is how many so-called prophets turned into court prophets. How many people were so delighted to get their invitations, reveled in the symbolic significance of having a Black family in the White House. Important. My son grew up in that. But what we all know is that it opened up the aftertimes. What did we get in response to Obama's election? We got, the vitriol of the Tea Party, voter suppression, voter ID laws. And then we threw up Donald Trump. Right. And people were trying to say that, you know, the election of a Black president was the culmination of the Black freedom struggle. And it irked the hell out of me, Tom. But that's not the comb. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I assume you never got that invitation to the White House.
And never wanted one, to be honest with you. But it's it bothers me when we tell a lie about the Black freedom struggle in order to justify this myth of the country, right? How we can conscript. And Baldwin and King understood this in 68. I write about this in the book when they're both speaking in Disneyland, right, at this hotel with Marlon Brando, trying to raise money for the Poor People's Campaign. They know what's on the horizon. They're trying to re-narrate the movement because they see it being conscripted in real time into a broader story of American exceptionalism. And you could see it even at the funeral of John Lewis. It happened, right? When President Clinton, out of the blue, decides to chastise the movement for perhaps going astray for 2 years and following too closely to Stokely. That little quip.
They elected Stokely Carmichael as the head of SNCC instead of John Lewis.
Little moment, Clinton's telling us how we should struggle, how we should think about what constitutes legitimate forms of dissent. That's part of a broader way in which people narrate the struggle in order to align it with this particular imagining of the country. It's all part of the lie, as I understand it.
The book is called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. The author is my guest, Dr. Eddie Glaude. Eddie, we have a tweet from a listener, and I think this is a really good point. She's interested in your take. Her name is Jennifer. She's interested in your take on if and why this denial, this lie, is such an American phenomenon, or is it? And what was Baldwin's perspective? And of course, Baldwin spent an awful lot of time outside of America, and you write about how he needed to be away from the United States to be able to get some distance to be able to observe it even more acutely.
You know, thank you for being such a close reader of the book, Tom. I really appreciate it. You know, it's not unique to America to tell itself stories. Right, to hide our sins, right? I mean, I suppose if we were in France, that we would tell ourselves a particular story that would hide the sins of our colonial, brutality. One could assume that nations rely on, right, certain kinds of stories to fortify its sense of itself. I think where America may be unique is our insistence on our innocence, right? The various rituals that we have in place to keep us from confronting the ugliness of who we are and what we've done. So we're not unique in our lives. We may be very much unique in our willingness to simply stick our heads in the sand. And it has something to do with, let me be a little bit clearer here. I think it has something to do with some Americans can't imagine themselves apart from the idea that America is a Redeemer nation. What would it mean to our identity to not assume that America is the city on the hill? Right? And so when I write in the book, for example, that the idea of white America is irredeemable, but it doesn't mean that we are. That's a hard distinction to make because it's...
Boy, it sure is, isn't it?
Yeah, the ideology of America is so bound up with who we take ourselves to be. And I think that's what makes us unique in some ways, right? If that makes sense.
It does. And talk a little bit more. Let's dig a little deeper about what confronting the past, confronting the lie, confronting the history, being... you know, open to and vulnerable and willing to acknowledge what we've done as a country. What are Baldwin's lessons and your own lessons for example, the Black Lives Matter movement today? What does it actually mean? What does it look like to confront those realities?
We can think about it in our own lives, right? As individuals, right? What would it mean to confront that moment or those moments that constitute the terror that moves us around, right? How might I imagine myself as a man from Mississippi who's trying to tell the truth in the little time that I have between womb and tomb, and who is desperately, right, indebted to this strong man and woman who made him possible, right? What does it mean for me to deal with my daddy, right, in an mm-hmm. honest way? And how does that then release me into being a different kind of father, a different kind of human being? So I say that I begin there at the personal because I think we can make the parallel at the national level. If we are committed to an idea of a more just world, we have to tell ourselves a story about how we've gotten in the way of ourselves, right? What has blocked the way to such a thing? And, you know, I say to friends all the time, you know, it's easy to take down a Robert E. Lee statue, but what if I told you that the highways of Chicago are monuments too? Right? Yeah. That our built environment actually reflects this ideology. So what Baldwin would say, and I don't want to put words in Jimmy's mouth, but I think what I'm trying to argue is that once we tell a different story, we tell the truth, then that becomes the first stage in reconciliation, which is the second stage, which then leads us into the third stage, which is repair. This is to echo Bryan Stevenson's wonderful formulation that truth and reconciliation is sequential. So we tell the truth about who we are and what we've done, which will then release us into perhaps reconciling with each other, which will then lead us to trying to build at the level of policy a more just world. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And your comment about the built environment is so, so true. I mean, it's true in Chicago. It's true in Atlanta. It's true in Boston. It's true right here in Baltimore, two blocks from where I sit in my house. There's a exit for a highway that completely upended and wiped out a black business community along a main thoroughfare here in town called North Avenue. Mm-hmm. It's ever so important. We just have a minute left.
Sure.
When we talk about the current political moment in regard to Mr. Trump, you say our task is then not to save Trump voters, nor is it to demonize them. It's to work with every ounce of passion and every drop of love we have to make the kingdom new. What does a love-infused dialogue with the political right sound like?
Well, it's really just simply putting forward a vision of a more just world where the dignity and sacrality of every human being is acknowledged and evidenced in the very ways in which we distribute advantage and disadvantage. To put it more simply, right, I don't want to argue with the Trump voter anymore. I don't want to convince them that their commitments to the fact that I'm less than, that they ought not to have those commitments. I'm more interested in building a just world. I want to have an argument about Medicare for all. I want to have an argument about a living wage. I want to have an argument about building a public infrastructure of care that includes a broad understanding of public safety. I want us to have an argument about what are the pillars of a more just society that has at its heart, you know, the belief that every human being is sacred and finally discards the idea that there are disposable people.
Well, Eddie Glaude, this book gives us a lot to think about. Thank you so much for the book and for your time today. It's always great to talk to you.
Always, Tom. Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
This has been an archive edition of Midday. We've been listening to a conversation I recorded in August with Dr. Eddie Glaude of Princeton University about his latest book. It's called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Tomorrow afternoon, Eddie Glaude will give the annual Dr. Martin Luther King Lecture for the Enoch Pratt Library in conjunction with the Reginald F. Lewis Museum and the Baltimore Office of Promotion and the Arts. It's a virtual event which begins at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And Monday here on Midday, we'll celebrate the Martin Luther King holiday and day of service by featuring three people who are making a difference in Baltimore. J.C. Falk of Be More Community Food, Dr. Maricela Gomez of the Village of Love and Resistance in East Baltimore, and Bishop Bruce Lewandowski of the Sacred Heart of Jesus Church in Highlandtown. That's coming up Monday on Midday. That's it for us today. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Rob Sivek is our senior producer. Jamila Krimple is WYVR's digital content director. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.